This is Ozarks at Large for Monday, December 10th, 2012. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Support for KUAF comes from the Peel Compton Foundation, celebrating the holidays with the Peel Mansion Victorian Christmas Tour, which wraps up today. Located in downtown Bentonville, the mansion will be open for extended evening hours today. PeelCompton.org for more information. Theater Square continues its seventh season with Period of Adjustment, with performances now through December 30th at Walton Arts Center's Nadine Baum Studio. This play rediscovers Tennessee Williams' only comedy, a humorous and poignant exploration of love and the need for human warmth. Tickets and information are available at theater2.org or 443-5600. Ahead on this edition of Ozarks, author Adam Vine stops by the studio to discuss his first collection of poetry titled The Coal Life. Also, we learn more about a group of researchers at the University of Arkansas who have developed a thermal energy storage system. And Roby Brock from our content partner TalkBusiness.net brings us the latest political and business headlines from around the state. Becca Martin Brown from Northwest Arkansas Newspapers has our entertainment suggestions for this evening and more. But first, as more Arkansans crank up their furnaces, water heaters, and other appliances with much cooler temperatures in the coming days, officials are warning of the increased risk for carbon monoxide poisoning. Symptoms such as headaches, dizziness, vomiting, and seizures can result from high levels of carbon monoxide in a person's home. Lisa Washburn is with the University of Arkansas Cooperative Extension Service.
There are some groups of people who are more susceptible to carbon monoxide poisoning than others. It most commonly affects people over the age of 65, but pregnant women, people with anemia, lung disease or heart disease, and young children are also at increased risk.
Washburn advises people to install carbon monoxide detectors in their homes and have all gas appliances professionally inspected every year. Governor Mike Beebe says if Washington shifts the funding responsibility for certain mandatory programs to the states, Arkansas might have to take the federal government to court. Beebe used his weekly radio address Friday to say he's optimistic that Washington can come to an agreement on the budget before mandatory spending cuts and tax increases take place. But he says Washington shouldn't reach an agreement by making program cuts at the expense of states.
We're concerned that federal money for those programs could be reduced to show a savings, but the mandates would still exist. This would place the burden on states to redirect significant money away from other necessary services. We will work as a state to protect programs that lose federal funds, but rigid mandates could put us in court if our limited resources cannot fully compensate for them.
Beebe says he left Washington confident that Congress and the president will be able to come to an agreement on the budget. The Fayetteville Farmers Market will begin its first ever winter market this weekend at the Botanical Garden of the Ozarks. Although the winter weather may not permit the availability of all the market's summer offerings, vendors at the winter market will have a wide selection for sale, including root vegetables, winter squashes, eggs, meats, and a variety of produce from greenhouses, including tomatoes, cucumbers, lettuces, and fresh herbs. Lori Boatwright is the manager of the Fayetteville Farmers Market.
It's been something that the market's been looking at for a while, with our vendors moving towards being able to produce food year-round. We've been looking at a winter market. And also, we, you know, just got a deal worked with the Botanical Garden. And just Saturday, we erected a large tent in the meadow just south of the market. And so we'll have some shelter and be able to house not only the vendors, but the shoppers as well.
The decision to hold the winter market at the Botanical Gardens was simple, as the farmers market was already in the process of getting more sheltered space for vendors at the market's regular season.
Well, we'd actually started working on this tent project back in the summer, and just got all final city approval to put it up now. So kind of two birds with one stone, and give us a shot for a winter market, as well as get the tent up for a trial run and see how it works in that space. You know, downtown, we really just don't have the availability for an indoor space.
Boatwright says she expects to see 25 to 30 vendors at the Saturday market through the winter, many of whom participate in the Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday downtown markets and Sunday markets during the regular farmers market season. Hours for the winter markets are 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. starting the Saturday. The winter market will be held on Saturdays at the Botanical Gardens through the month of March, with the regular farmers market season beginning in April. The city of Fayetteville has a new anti-litter and beautification organization. Late last week, city officials officially unveiled Keep Fayetteville Beautiful. City Waste Reduction Coordinator Brian Pugh says the organization is an affiliate of Keep America Beautiful and Keep Arkansas Beautiful.
And the mission for these affiliates are to improve in these communities that they serve. Education components as it pertains to waste reduction and recycling and litter prevention, beautification projects. That's all part of what we're trying to do with Keep Fayetteville Beautiful and make sure that we can coordinate volunteers, get the community involved, get businesses involved to help us achieve those goals.
Pugh says by encouraging a clean overall appearance in the city, Keep Fayetteville Beautiful can help attract tourism and other dollars to the city.
It also helps these communities when businesses that are looking for places to come and move to and become part of the community, if they come in and they see a community that's vibrant and clean with a good, strong community involvement in these programs and showing that it's important, then they're more likely to invest in these communities. So the payback to Fayetteville could be pretty significant if we can ensure that our community is clean and green and has these programs in place to help draw in tourism and other businesses.
While Fayetteville has several community and civic groups working on beautification, recycling, and sustainability efforts, Pugh says Keep Fayetteville Beautiful will help the city coordinate all of those efforts in addition to making the city eligible for certain grant funding. Tonight's weather forecast calls for clear conditions with a low of 14 degrees in northwest Arkansas and a low of 22 degrees in the Arkansas River Valley. Tomorrow, expect clear skies with a high in the mid to upper 40s. And tomorrow night, expect those clear skies to continue with a low of 23 degrees.
I'm Roby Brock with your Talk Business Update, a recap of the biggest business and political headlines of the last week. Brett Bielema, head football coach for the University of Wisconsin Badgers, has been hired to be the next head coach for the Arkansas Razorbacks. Bielema, age 42, replaces John L. Smith, who was hired on an interim basis at Arkansas after Bobby Petrino was fired for an inappropriate relationship with a University of Arkansas employee and then lying about that relationship. Now, across the state, Arkansas State University head football coach Gus Malzahn will return to Auburn to take over for fired football coach Gene Chizik. Malzahn, an Arkansas native and former University of Arkansas assistant coach, has coached at ASU for just one season, leading the team to a 9-3 record. Malzahn was offensive coordinator when Auburn won the national championship in 2010. Governor Mike Beebe said his Tuesday meeting with President Obama and Vice President Biden regarding the fiscal cliff being debated in Washington was an effort to promote compromise. Beebe was part of a bipartisan group of six governors who met at the White House for nearly 90 minutes to discuss the impact of certain decisions on state budgets and economies. Individual income taxes continue to support modest growth in Arkansas's overall state revenues as state sales collections remain almost flat compared to forecast. In its November revenue report, Department of Finance and Administration officials noted that year-to-date net available general revenues totaled nearly $2 billion. That was up 2.8% above last year's levels and a mere 0.2% above forecast. Fort Smith-based Arkansas Best said its global shipping services now reach through all of Europe and Turkey. A similar service has been in place for Asia and India. The Fort Smith-based less-than-truckload company has offices ranging from Belgium to Germany to Italy, Poland, Spain, Turkey, and the United Kingdom. Entergy Arkansas has completed the purchase of the Hot Spring Energy Facility, a power plant that sits less than a mile from where the Arkansas Power and Light founder Harvey Couch ran the first transmission line between Malvern and Arkadelphia in 1913. Arkansas and Power and Light was part of a predecessor of utility companies to the modern-day Entergy system. Couch was the CEO and business leader who started Arkansas Power and Light and sister entities in Louisiana and Mississippi. Entergy Arkansas announced plans to acquire the plant in 2011 and assumed ownership on November 30th. The 620-megawatt combined cycle natural gas turbine unit was purchased from KGen Hot Spring for approximately $253 million and that is much less than it costs to construct a new comparable facility. Pediatrics Plus opened a new $7.2 million, 31,000 square foot facility in Little Rock that will create 50 new jobs serving children and families with disabilities and developmental delays. I'm Roby Brock, and that is your Talk Business Update.
This is Ozarks at Large. A group of engineering researchers at the University of Arkansas has developed a thermal energy storage system that will increase energy production and efficiency while decreasing damages and production costs. Ozarks at Large's Christina Thomas recently visited the Research and Technology Park to learn more.
So what we are looking here is supposedly the solar power plant collects about 550 degrees centigrade heat.
That's Dr. Panir Selvam. He's a professor of computational mechanics and nanotechnology at the University of Arkansas. Many large power plants work on solar thermal energy, so they can only operate when the sun's out. Dr. Selvam and his team are trying to find a way they can store the heat energy more efficiently.
So that heat, some of them goes to the power plant to make electricity, and some of them you store it in a big place. But here in the laboratory, we are trying to see the possibility of developing a technology. So what we are doing here is, can we use concrete as a medium to store that heat?
Currently, power plants are using a two-tank storage system using molten salt.
So what they do is, they when it comes out of the power plant, it is like 290 degrees or something. They put it in one big tank. Then from the solar panel, the heat they collected, they take it and put it in another tank. Then when they need the heat, they pump this molten salt from the big tank and then pump it to the power plant to make electricity. See that? That means they have to have two tanks. And then the molten salt is a little bit expensive.
Another method currently being used is packed rock. It's the least expensive but causes damage to tanks due to expansion. The technology being used here is just one tank and concrete, which is much cheaper than salt. They are able to use 70% concrete. The other 30% is still salt.
So what you are looking at the test setup here in the lab, what we are doing is...
He says here in the lab, but we're really outside where the test tank is set up. Solar energy is too expensive for this project, so they use propane burners to heat the salt and concrete, heating up to 600 degrees Celsius, much too hot to be inside. And the tank is large. It's an odd-looking contraption. One side looks like a mini water tower hovering over the rectangular tank. There's a tube connecting the two. Both sides are covered with a fuzzy-looking white insulation.
The molten salt is in that box there. You melt it by about 220 degrees.
Fahrenheit or?
So all of them centigrade. Let's stay with centigrade. So that it's, because if not, the number is much bigger. Then you pump it into this chamber here. That's where the concrete test specimens are inside. Then the molten salt heat goes in, heats it up, then it comes out back there. So we just keep on rotating it and trying to study the performance of it.
Graduate student Matt Strasser came in after the project was underway. He says the concrete used is special.
I came into it when a previous student had actually designed concrete mix, or he had developed some concrete for this, because typical structural concrete explodes at 200 to 300 centigrade. So where I came in is he had designed the four concrete mix designs, and I came into the beginning where we were actually constructing this concrete to test. And then I've been conducting some of the actual thermal testing of it.
He's evaluating the concrete to see if it's chemically compatible with the salt and structurally compatible with the tank. He's also looking at the cost comparison of a one-tank and a two-tank system. Using a model from the Electric Power Institute and the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, Strasser was able to conduct the tests on their small tank system and translate those numbers to cost savings for much larger tanks used at power plants.
See, here is what the cost of the, this is really, this is total cost or the storage cost?
This is per kilowatt hour thermal.
Kilowatt hour. So it's a storage cost. Is you could see that the packed bed is $30. The structured concrete is ours is $33.
And in this two tank he was talking about, it's around $45.
The results showed that the concrete conducted heat with an efficiency of 93.9%. Tests also confirmed that the concrete conducted heat without causing damage to materials used for storage. Also, energy storage using the concrete method cost only 78 cents per kilowatt hour, far below the Department of Energy's goal of achieving thermal energy storage at a cost of $15 per kilowatt hour. Speaking of the Department of Energy, this project is actually the result of a grant that Selvin received. $770,000, actually.
See, because the big power plants, that's where they are looking. So Department of Energy is putting the money. There are different technologies they wanted to develop so that they can pick the best one.
Selvin, Strasser, and team must have their findings turned in by December 31st. When that's done, they'll continue work, but on a much smaller scale. While this project has been looking at huge power plant storage tanks,
so whether we could use it for heating chicken houses, normal houses in the farm, a little bit far away, or even in cities, if there's some space there where we can collect the solar heat. So we are really looking into those kind of level also. That way in the winter time, we can store and heat it in the night time. So that way the use of gas or electricity for heating can be reduced.
My favorite project they're working on is looking at using solar energy to keep ice off of bridges. No more signs that caution against slick pavement. Strasser, who just graduated with his master's, will be a doctoral academy fellow pursuing his PhD in an area associated with solar or thermal energy. For Ozarks at Large, I'm Christina Thomas.
Today is the 45th anniversary of the plane crash that claimed the lives of Otis Redding and four members of the Barkays outside of Madison, Wisconsin. The sole survivor of that crash was Barkays trumpet player Ben Colley. Colley would defy the odds several more times in his remarkable life. He suffered a massive stroke, which left him with speech difficulty, but he kept performing. Colley turned 65 this year, and Sarah Hoover from our content partner WKNO in Memphis brings us his story.
Colley got into music singing in church. He picked up the trumpet in seventh grade and formed the Barkays with friends at Booker T. Washington High School. Colley and his bandmates were in high demand at local clubs like the Hippodrome. Colley says Otis Redding followed them there to offer them a gig. By the spring of 1967, the group was Redding's backing band. Here they are performing live with Redding.
What you want, you got it. What you need, baby, you got. All I'm asking for a little respect when I come home.
Stax wanted to cut a record with the Barkays. In the middle of a recording session, they took a break. Stax founder, Jim Stewart, stepped out of the room. As Colley recalls, the group began to jam and created their signature song, Soul Finger.
It's something we put together, and man, that's a hit.
Soul Finger was the Barkays' first single. It reached number 3 on Billboard's R&B chart. With a hit and a tour with Redding, the Barkays felt they were on their way.
And from that point on, things are looking really up from that point on.
But 6 months later, five Barkays and Otis Redding climbed aboard a small plane to fly from Cleveland to Madison, Wisconsin. The plane crashed in icy Lake Monona. Colley was thrown into the freezing water. The musician didn't know how to swim, but he held on to a seat cushion. He survived until a police boat arrived and suffered hypothermia and shock.
I just couldn't swim, and I didn't try.
Since the crash, Colley has played with numerous bands, including a reconstituted Barkays, Isaac Hayes, and the Muscle Shoals Band. In 1989, Colley suffered a massive stroke and aneurysm. Doctors gave him 3 days to live. Miraculously, he survived. Although initially paralyzed, he relearned how to walk, talk, read, and write. He was soon back playing his horn and performing, something doctors said he would never do. Colley returned to the site of the plane crash 40 years later. He sang Redding's Sittin' on the Dock of the Bay as part of a ceremony at the Monona Terrace on the banks of the lake. Colley evaded another close brush with death when he avoided a diabetic coma. At 65, Colley still writes and records songs at his home and gigs with the Bow Keys. Every Sunday, Collie attends Calvary Longview United Methodist Church, where he sings with the choir. Collie has been with the church for a long time, more than 20 years.
Just a sample of what Gabriel's going to do for us when we walk in the streets of gold.
On a recent Sunday, the church's Hammond B3 organ was broken. Instead of playing the organ, Collie shuffled up to the microphone and performed an impromptu trumpet solo. Then he sang. The song was, "He Knows Just How Much You Can Bear." In Memphis, I'm Sarah Hoover.
It's Monday, December 10th, 2012, and this is Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda, and joining me now is Becca Martin-Brown, Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Isn't it about the time we say, how can it be the 10th of December?
Oh, I was just thinking about that. I was saying 2012. I was like, I'm just getting used to saying it, and now I'm going to have to be done saying it pretty soon, and
I will say that thanks to the art sales last weekend, my Christmas shopping is done.
I need to shop for things.
Eat your hearts out, people. All right, going on tonight. Until 3 o'clock today, there's an exhibit called The Van Winkle Legacy, the story of Northwest Arkansas's first great entrepreneur that's on exhibit at the Rogers, not at the Rogers Historical Museum, it's by the Rogers Historical Museum, on exhibit at the Bentonville Public Library. And if you need to get out and do some theater, auditions tonight at 7 o'clock at the Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale for Night Must Fall. It's not an Agatha Christie, but it's the same premise. Little sleepy English village in, I think, 1939. And a new man comes to town and shakes everything up. And then there's a severed head or a headless body, one or the other. And
so murder mystery. And it's at the Art Center of the Ozarks. They usually do something like that in February.
About this time of year. Okay. So 7 o'clock for auditions tonight at ACO. You can find out more at 751-5441.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin-Brown is Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansas Songs. Albert King was born Albert Nelson on April 25, 1923, in Indianola, Mississippi, and had become the father of modern blues guitar. Albert's father, Will Nelson, also played guitar. The Nelson family, including Albert and his dozen siblings, moved to East Arkansas, first Forest City in St. Francis County, and then Osceola in Mississippi County in the early 1930s. Young Albert sang in church and grew up picking cotton and admiring guitarists Lonnie Johnson and Blind Lemon Jefferson. In Osceola, Albert joined a band called the Groove Boys. From there, beyond Osceola's own music scene, he soaked up music nearby from the nightclubs of wide open West Memphis, Arkansas.
I'm going down, down there. My nose is in the sand. I'm going down, 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 babe. My nose is in the sand. A cloud of dust has came over me. I think I'm drowning on dry land.
From From the late 1940s through the 1950s, Albert King honed his craft. He lived in St. Louis, Missouri, Gary, Indiana, and Chicago, Illinois, and played drums in addition to guitar. King even briefly drummed with blues man Jimmy Reed. In 1953, while in Chicago, Albert King's first single, Bad Luck Blues, on the Parrot record label, found some regional success, but King returned to St. Louis. While there, he recorded for the city's Bobbin label and tried out the Flying V-style guitars that would become his trademark. That's a bad way to go. Finally, in 1961, Albert King found some national recognition when a song, Don't Throw Your Love on Me So Strong, with Ike Turner on piano, broke into the R&B Top 15. Cincinnati, Ohio's King Records, no relation, bought Albert King's contract and collected his singles for the first Albert King album the next year in 1962. In the mid-1960s, Albert King moved back to home territory and signed with Stax Records of Memphis, Tennessee. King's band in the studio was the Stax House Band, Booker T and the MGs, with the Memphis Horns, including Wayne Jackson of West Memphis. King would stay with Stax Records for the next decade, including working with Stax executive and Brinkley native Al Bell until the label's financial collapse. Albert King was a rare straight-up blues artist on Stax, which is primarily an R&B record company. But King emerged as a blues giant during his time at Stax with the 1967 release of his second album ever, Born Under a Bad Sign. Albert King's Born Under a Bad Sign album is credited with not only modernizing and revolutionizing the blues world, but strongly influencing emerging rock and roll guitar styles on both sides of the Atlantic. If you're down and out, and you feel real hurt, come on over to the place where I all your loneliness, I'll try to soothe. I'll play the blues. In later years, Albert King played guitar while puffing a pipe on stage. Emblazoned on King's touring bus was both a promise and another one of his well-known song titles, I'll Play the Blues For You. King was left-handed, but played right-handed guitars. Again, generally Flying V guitars, upside down, and didn't use a guitar pick. 2013 Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee Albert King died of a heart attack December 21, 1992, at his home in Memphis, Tennessee. King had played a concert in Los Angeles, California, just 2 days prior. Following a funeral procession in Memphis along Beale Street, King was buried at Paradise Garden Cemetery in nearby Edmondson, Arkansas, in southern Crittenden County, close to his childhood home, while the blues guitar work of Albert King continues to ring on through thousands of guitarists across the globe. Here in its entirety is Albert King of East Arkansas with The Hunter from King's landmark 1967 album, Born Under a Bad Sign.
Like you is my only game. I bought me a says to myself, "Whoa, ain't she sweet? I got my love gun loaded with hugs and kisses, and when I pull the trigger,
Albert King, who lived and is buried in East Arkansas with The Hunter from his groundbreaking 1967 blues album, Born Under a Bad Sign. It's another song of Arkansas. From Little Rock, I'm Stephen Cook with Arkansongs.
Arkansongs is a production of FM 89 and Experiment Station Studios. Associate producer of Arkansongs is Keith Merks. For more information, visit arkansongs.org. Arkansongs, since 1999.
This is Ozarks at Large. Adam Vines' poetry mixes language and the natural world. His first collection of poems, The Coal Life, was published by the University of Arkansas Press. Adam Vines is assistant professor of English at the University of Alabama, Birmingham. Recently, he read at Nightbird Books as a guest of the Ozark Poets and Writers Collective. The morning after that reading, he talked with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums.
Seems like even when I'm inside, I'm looking outside. My poems that start out on the inside, there's always an open window, or there's always a plant. There's always something that's drawing me back to the natural world. And that's because I've spent probably more time, more waking hours in the natural world than I have inside or in the man-made world.
When you were a professional landscaper, were you coming up with lines and observations that you would put down?
I was, yeah. It's a very different kind of writing when you're outside. And living in Birmingham, I couldn't carry a piece of paper and a pad and a pen with me because I'm just so sweaty. I tried to do that a few times, and I'm just dripping everywhere, and, you know, it's a mess. So I started thinking about lines in my head and constructing lines and images in my head, and I did a lot of my writing in my head. And then when I would get home, I could sit down, and I was excited about writing, which is different from being involved with language all day long. Sometimes you burn out if you're grading all day, and the last thing you want to do is approach language. I want to go outside and get my maul and my chainsaw and cut wood, you know?
Right.
It's like the landscaper whose yard looks awful. You know, you come home,
Busman's
the last
holiday,
thing you want
right?
to do. Yeah. But... yeah, the landscape is in the natural world always, and there's always a body of water in some way. I'm always going back to the river or going back to the bay.
Or rain.
Or rain, sure.
Your poem, Burying the Dead.
Mm-hmm.
I thought I was the only weird kid who no. would bury the little army men or cowboys uh-huh. and Indians. You did too.
I did. That's an autobiographical poem. And I actually went back, when I wrote that poem, I went back to my childhood home and asked the people if I could go in the backyard, and I found a cowboy and an Indian and a bunch of army men that were still deep underground, you know, in this one area that didn't have a lot of wash, and they thought I was crazy when I asked, but it was right next to Trinity Church, and you know, all of that, the environment for the poem is spot on. And my mother asking me to come in and all of that, I actually, you know, asked her about what I was like. And she said, you used to do that constantly.
And you mentioned in the poem, you wave her off as your father might.
Right.
How do you, and the observation of looking across the street and seeing your father and hearing his hammer and the nails clinking, mm-hmm. how do you get to the point where you remember that? Because so many of us, when approached with something from our past by another person, go, oh, that's right, mm-hmm. but we would never think of that on our own.
I think that some of it is memory, and I think some of it is just observation over the years that's kind of infiltrated into that memory. I think that it's true. It's all plausible. It may not have been in that one experience when it's raining that one day for that one poem. But, you know, when I was in the backyard hearing my father coming home, it may have been another day, but this was a combination, a marriage of experiences that creates a small poem like this. This poem is also a recurring dream that I had.
Really?
Yeah. I had it up until my daughter. I haven't had it since my daughter was born, but I had it after my father died when I was 19, probably 5, 6, 7 times, and I would wake up in a panic. What I don't have in the end of the poem, which I have in the end of the dream, is I'm walking around the church trying to catch up to him, and I can't catch up to him. And in the end, he's at a playground pushing another child on a swing, and he doesn't know me. So it's as if he has a different life and a different child. And I guess that's part of that separation anxiety that I find more and more in the book that just happened unconsciously, the separation of father and son, whether it's through religion or physically in the poems with the coal miners, you know, the father who's the coal miner and the child who's at home.
There is the poem Threat of Spring, mm-hmm. about the father who's a coal miner and washing, getting the coal dust off. It's a very vivid poem, and I am guessing you labored over the exact words in that poem.
Oh, yes.
Because none of them are wrong. Mm-mm. They're all, and none of them are only okay. They're all exactly right.
Well, thanks, yeah.
How do you do, I mean, sweat?
Sweat. I mean, it's writing is labor. It's blue-collar work, and I tell my students that. I have it on my syllabus. I say writing is hard work. It's blue-collar work. I had a mentor who was a Beowulf scholar, and toward the end of his life, he took on the task of writing his Beowulf translation, which, you know, all scholars end up doing. Sadly, he wrote his right after Seamus Heaney wrote his.
Well, there you
so
go,
of
yeah.
course, it, you know, but it's true to the prosody. It's a fantastic representation. And I remember talking to him when he was very sick, and trying to finish it up when I was in Florida. I said, "What are you doing, Steve?" And he said, "I'm hammering out half lines." And I thought the idea of that labor at the forge, hammering out these half lines, and I started thinking about it, and that's kind of what I do in my poetry too. I feel like it's not about sitting down and being inspired, and you know, it really is. It's about, with me, it's hard work. It's coming up with the language that perfectly represents the experience.
Is the right word for you, the author? Or the right word for me, the reader?
I think I'm thinking of both of them, because the problem is I could become too esoteric where I lose my readership, and I've got to be careful with that. You want language that's evocative, and you want language that perhaps give people a vision of something that they've seen every day in a fresh manner, but you don't want to use language that they're so unfamiliar with that they give up and they're not going to look it up, or it's too Latinate and it's clunky and it's gait. But I love the language of coal mining. I love that esoteric language of fishing, you know, of industries. I think that what I love poetry that brings in language from other disciplines and then brings it into the poem instead of poetic language.
There are a couple of people with the name Williams that are now attached to your bio forever.
Yeah.
You're a Tennessee Williams scholar at Sewanee.
Right.
A finalist for the Miller Williams Poetry Prize. Those are two nice names to have hanging around.
It's your beautiful.
Own.
I mean, it's, yeah, I don't deserve it, that's for sure. But, no, I love the idea of being tied to both of those great writers and great Southern writers. Again, I'm older, but I'm just a kid starting out. You know, this is my first collection. I haven't been writing seriously for that many years. I'm really just kind of starting my teaching career, and I'm still, I don't even know where I'm going to go with my second collection yet. You know, I'm writing to it, I guess, but I'm not sure where I'm going yet.
You teach.
I do.
One of the most interesting and most disturbing things on the web is ratemyprofessor.com. However, I have to mention, and I wasn't stalking, this is preparing, but universally, the comments about your teaching mention passion and wanting to, because I am imagining you're not just teaching English majors or
no,
you're teaching a general population. All the comments are about this apparent desire to share your love of the language with all the students. You, it appears that you like to teach.
I do. I adore teaching. I had wonderful mentors. I changed majors two or three times. Like I said, I wasn't taking classes to get a practical degree where I would go out into the workforce. I was just intrigued with knowledge. And I had two professors in particular, Jim Mersman and Bob Collins, who encouraged me to write. And they had that kind of, I mean, you walked in their class and they were so excited, they were beating on the desk, you know, and I get that way sometimes. I had a class two classes ago where I was talking about James Merrill, and I read The Doodler, and I was reading parts of it, and I just couldn't contain myself, and I just started wailing. I had the book, and I was doing this, and, you know, beating it on the desk, and everybody's eyes are huge, and they're, you know, they think I'm a madman, and I am a madman when it comes to this. Another thing, I worked full-time, and I work at a university that's turning into more of a traditional university, but we still have quite a few working students. We have quite a few first-year or first-generation college students. I think that I understand them maybe more. I'm not a bow-tie-wearing professor. You know, I'm a guy who comes in with bloody hands because I've been out doing stuff before class. You know, I got dirt under my fingernails because I put my hands in the soil. And I think when I talk about hard work and I talk about these poems and I talk about the experience in the poems, that they trust me. And I think that we make a connection in that way. And I truly do believe that in a mentorship where I'm not merely someone who is above the class and gives grades. I'm someone who's there to encourage. I wish I didn't have to give grades. I wish that we could just rely on everyone coming in with integrity and everyone working hard and just support systems that evolved out of that. But I do have to give grades.
Another thing that you do at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, is you're the advisor to the UAB fishing team, correct?
I am.
Because you love to fish.
Because I love to fish. I had some students who approached me 5 or 6 years ago about starting a team. And I didn't even know about university fishing teams. You know, if I would have had one when I was no telling where I would have ended up. But they approached me, and of course I said I would do it. I didn't have a lot of time. My old position I had at UAB, I taught a 4-4, so four classes a semester and a lot of lower-level teaching, which I love, but it's intensive. And I said I would do it, and that first year we won the region and did extremely against teams that had won national championships, Auburn and Alabama. The next year, we had a team that placed 7th in the nation out of 160 teams. So we've done pretty well, especially because we have kids who they're not wealthy and they don't come in with a 21-foot boat and they don't have the money to travel to Texas and to drive a boat to Texas to compete. So they have to be really choosy in the tournaments that they fish. And again, many of these students are working full-time, and the university, sadly, isn't able to support them at all.
The U of A, the University of Birmingham bass fishing team, has done very well.
They've done extremely well. Yeah, I just saw some results. I think that they're in the top rankings right now. But, yeah, it's exciting. And another thing, these students, if you're a fisherman or a fisherwoman, and luckily we've had two women on the team, and that's been fantastic, you have to get up very early in the morning. So, you know, the Thursday night going out, you know, these students can't do that. Or you can't get up on Friday and fish. Or you can't get up on Friday and do a practice day. So I think that, you know, there's something about keeping them out of the bars and keeping them on the water, which I like too. Keeping them in the natural world. I think that it's better for their academic studies, too. I think that it's nourishing to the mind to be out there in a kind of Thoreauvian sense.
The collection is called The Coal Life. It's published by the University of Arkansas Press. There's one more poem I want to ask you about that I found online that's not in there.
Sure.
And it's The Golden Years.
Yeah.
I love this poem.
I read it last night, actually. Yeah. It's a pantoum, which is a Malaysian form, a repeating form. And it was me thinking about, you know, getting older and, you know, the term golden years, how, you know, you reach your golden years. And I'm not sure how golden they are, really. Maybe it's a little pessimistic in what it's doing. But at the same time, I hope that there's a sweetness that comes through.
There is.
Where, you know, you're using the same lines, but the I said and the placement of the I said. You have one person who's talking to another person who may be going through a bit of dementia. And this mate gets a little frustrated. But in the end, I think that there's a kind of a wonderful connection that happens, you know, where I'm going to take care of you now instead of, God, here we are, and you're getting old, and, you know, you're sick, and, you know, this is how I'm going to have to spend the rest of my years. And I'm hoping that it's my wife's in much better shape than I am, and she's younger, so maybe that's me projecting a bit, too.
Well, it's a wonderful poem because you read it more than once. You finish it, and you're not quite sure what happened, and so you go back.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't mean that in a it's hard to decipher.
Right.
But it takes that second reading to, I see.
Yeah, that's a poem that I'm hoping is going to shape this next collection. A lot of my poems in this next collection are more autobiographical, and I think that this one is more me, you know, and my anxieties. Though my anxieties are always projected or transferred onto the personae that I assume, here I think that's much more closely related to my own fears. At 43, I was telling my students, you know, once you reach 40 or so, it's no longer, you know, it's what you have left instead of, you know, and I'm not being pessimistic about that. I was just being practical, you know. I'm probably not going to live to be twice as old as I am.
So. You begin to think about these things that the first day of spring or a Christmas Eve. It's like
you do.
You can start figuring out that there are only so many to go. And I know that right now someone 25 years older than us is just laughing at us, right?
Of course, of course. And I know how ridiculous it is, you know. And my mother kind of tells me that, you know. She's going on 70 and she's enjoying herself more than she's ever enjoyed herself, I think, especially having grandkids. And, you know, she's not scared of what's to come. And I'm not scared either. But it's funny to think that you're over that edge, though. You're counting down instead of counting up,
right?
Maybe.
The Coal Life, published by the University of Arkansas Press. It's available anywhere online. It's also locally here at the University of Arkansas bookstores, Nightbird Books. Adam Vines, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. Appreciate it.
Adam Vines' first collection of poetry is titled The Coal Life, published by the University of Arkansas Press. He was in Fayetteville earlier this month as a guest of the Ozark Poets and Writers Collective. He is assistant professor of English at the University of Alabama, Birmingham. He talked to Ozark's at-largest Kyle Kellums earlier this month during his visit. The next Ozark Poets and Writers featured writer is Jeff Olsner. He'll be at Nightbird Books in Fayetteville on Tuesday, January 29th.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 10th of December, 2012. The birthday of Emily Dickinson, Amherst, Massachusetts, 1830. Spent a number of years of her adult life in her corner bedroom in her father's house in Amherst, with a writing table, a dresser, a Franklin stove, a clock, a ruby decanter, and pictures of George Eliot, Elizabeth Barrett Browning, and Thomas Carlyle on the wall. In the year 1862 alone, she wrote 366 poems, about one per day. She'd been outgoing in her younger years, was reclusive later on. Some scholars have thought she was nursing a broken heart. Others thought she was a closeted lesbian. Still others think she suffered from seasonal affect disorder. One biographer said she may have suffered from epilepsy. It's the birthday of Melville Dewey, born Adams Center, New York, 1851, who gave us the Dewey Decimal System, still used in many libraries today.
It was on this day, 1884, Mark Twain's The Adventures of Huckleberry Finn was first published. He started out to write a sequel to The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, but gave up on that and decided to write in the voice of Huckleberry Finn in dialect, a book that opens with the line, "You don't know about me without you have read a book by the name of The Adventures of Tom Sawyer, but that ain't no matter." It was Ernest Hemingway who said all modern literature comes from one book by Mark Twain, and he was referring to Huckleberry Finn. It was on this day, 1906, Theodore Roosevelt became the first American to win the Nobel Peace Prize for having helped to broker a peace agreement between Russia and Japan the previous year. It's the birthday of Carolyn Kaiser, born Spokane, 1925. And it's the birthday of the poet Thomas Lux, born Northampton, Massachusetts, 1946, author of poems with titles like Commercial Leech Farming Today, Traveling Exhibition of Torture Instruments, The Oxymoron Sisters, and Walt Whitman's Brain Dropped on Laboratory Floor. Thomas Lux, who describes contemporary American poetry as burgeoning, chaotic, healthy, squawking, boisterous, fractious, inclusive. Here's a poem for today by Emily Dickinson. This world is not conclusion. The word vain, by the way, in the line, and asks a vain, is V-A-N-E, indicating the direction of the wind, not a blood vessel, vain. This world is not conclusion. This world is not conclusion. A species stands beyond, invisible as music, but positive as sound. It beckons and it baffles philosophy. Don't know, and through a riddle at the last, sagacity must go. To guess it, puzzle scholars. To gain it, men have borne contempt of generations and crucifixion shown. Faith slips and laughs and rallies, blushes if any see, plucks at a twig of evidence and asks a vein the way. Much gesture from the pulpit, strong hallelujahs roll. Narcotics cannot still the tooth that nibbles at the soul. This World Is Not Conclusion by Emily Dickinson from her collected poems. That's the Writer's Almanac, supported by Reputation.com, helping businesses leverage a powerful form of advertising, online reviews. Learn more at Reputation.com. And by Allianz. Allianz has been providing investment, insurance, and retirement solutions through its affiliated companies in the United States since 1896. Written by Holly Vanderhaar, produced by Kathy Roach. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
KUAF is supported by Pack Rat Outdoor Center in Fayetteville, dedicated to environmental responsibility and serving the area for 38 years. Pack Rat offers a selection of footwear, canoes, and kayaks, camping gear, plus urban and outdoor clothing. A fan page is available on Facebook or packratoc.com for an events calendar or more information. The Elmer Performing Arts Center presents Miracle on 34th Street on Saturday, December 15th at 8 p.m. This nationally touring musical offers family humor, spectacle, and the message that Santa Claus is no myth. Tickets and more information are available at almapac.org or 632-2129. This is KUAF 91.3 FM Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Lowell. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Thanks so much for listening. Tune in tomorrow at noon for an all-new edition of Ozarks at Large. Have a great day.